Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Art of Tracking radio show. Tracking is still alive and well. Join us as we interview master trackers from around the world. We'll hear their stories, their secrets. So tune in and enjoy all you hear. Welcome.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Today we have Arthur Haynes, owner of the Delta Institute of Natural History. I've been a longtime fan of Arthur through the years. His knowledge is unparalleled in many topics. Are you there, Arthur?
I am. Thanks for having me on, Steve.
Great, man. I am very pleased to talk to you. You are definitely one of my fans and or one of my mentors. I guess I would love to hear, first off, how you got into all this, because it's always very interesting the different paths that people take to get into primitive skills and tracking and plants and all of that.
Yeah, that's always a fun topic because there's such a diversity of ways that people, you know, connect and stay connected with nature, that really ends up influencing their life. For me, I grew up in a really rural part of Western Maine, and that allowed all kinds of opportunity to, you know, spend time in natural settings, whether those were the forests or the brooks that we used to run along as children. And of course, like other children growing up in the 70s, we played cowboys and Indians, except I really liked being the Indians. I liked to be the Native Americans who were making bows and hunting with bows. And so that's always been kind of this lifelong pursuit that I'm not sure where that came from. But I will say it was meeting a friend in junior high who happened to have this book. And the name of the book, fittingly enough, was The Tracker. And it was first reading Tom Brown's work that really changed the way I started interacting with nature. Because, you know, rural Maine has very much of an exploitive worldview. In other words, the fish, the animals, the timber resources, those kind of things are here, you know, for people to use. And it was Tom Brown's teachings that really got me thinking about a very different way of looking at the world, but also about how important awareness and being able to read the landscape, to read the tracks, to read the changes that occur really is to our long-term health and well-being.
Yes, that name comes up often in my world, sir.
Yeah, I bet. You know, Tom Brown was such a... He really was an inspiration because he was one of the only people that were actually talking about not just identifying and following tracks, but actually interpreting each track to essentially discern what did that track mean? Was the animal, you know, picking up speed or slowing down? Was it turning? Was it pushing off? Was it weary? Was it wounded? You know, all of this kind of that could be picked up in tracks, just no one else was talking about except him. So I can understand how he could be a really big inspiration for a lot of people.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So you continued on and you built your school skills and you found a niche for some different things. I wonder what started really drawing your attention specific. Everybody has something they really love the most.
Well, certainly, Steve, I'm most known for plant-related skills. I teach primitive living skills, which, of course, includes tracking and nature awareness. And as part of this whole skill set, I began to realize that nearly everything we make, if it isn't made entirely out of plants, it has some plant component to it. The things that we eat, the medicines that we use, we even use plants as tools to make other tools for acquiring animal nutrition and these kinds of things. So I very quickly realized that plants were a foundational skill for what we do when we're in the forest, and that indigenous people were all essentially master botanists. So my goal has been to try to get people to sort of up their plant skill set, to take that skill to a new level and realize that without an ability to identify plants and learn how to craft things from them, it really hampers our ability to sort of practice these ancestral life ways.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's definitely one skill, you know, people ask me, you know, what's the most important thing? I'll say, well, one of the most important things is plants. For sure.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you think about it. If we want to make cordage, most of the time, at least initially, that's made out of plants. If we want to make a hunting weapon to take larger game, well, in all likelihood, that's going to be made out of plants. Our adhesives, our dyes, made out of plants. And I mean, we can just keep going with this. We even use plants to build shelters. We use plants to make other tools. I mean, our fire starting kits, if they're made from the landscape, are usually based not just on the materials of plants, but a really fine knowledge of how to use those plants, select the exact ones to be able to get an ember. I mean, it really does come down to plants being a really foundational skill set.
For sure, for sure. Will you tell me a little bit about your school before we actually dig in a little deeper?
Yeah, I run a school that's called the Delta Institute of Natural History, and this is a school that actually a friend and I started a number of years ago, and it taught a range of classes. They usually centered on foraging as well as plant taxonomy, because that ability to identify plants is really important. Obviously, you can't eat and make medicine from things that you don't know exactly what they are. And my friend who started this, who actually came up with the name, is a mathematician. And Delta is the, you know, mathematical symbol for change. And he really wanted to incorporate that meaning into the title, that as people came through these classes, that they would undergo some kind of change, hopefully in their awareness of their landscape around them. And so that's where the Delta Institute, or I should say the Delta part, came from. And of course, the natural history part, we often think of animals as having a natural history, but the sort of understanding of how they go about their life and the strategies they use to acquire food and avoid predators and all of these kind of things. But humans have a natural history too. It's just really concealed from us because we tend to spend time in urban landscapes where, you know, many other animals have been kind of expunged from that kind of a created landscape. But just the same, we have a natural history that was practiced by wild people, and the Delta Institute of Natural History is a place where we're trying to regain some of those skills because they're obviously so very useful even in today's world. And so my classes, while they tend to focus now on primitive living skills, the primary focus is plants for most of the classes. I teach a lot of foraging classes where people can learn about wild edibles, and I also do wildcrafting medicine and occasionally step into doing some other things. I'm actually hoping, Steve, next year to get into some sort of longer classes with much smaller students, student bodies. In other words, maybe just taking 1, 2, or 3 students and spending several weeks with them throughout the growing season and sort of working on this hunter-gatherer apprenticeship, which I'm really looking forward to because I love working in a really small group setting.
Wow, that sounds great. Plant intensives is definitely serious. My mentor, his grandparents and parents, they were always plant-based in the South, and he grew up with some knowledge, and, you know, obviously it's limited until you find a professional, if you will. But he went to tracker school, and he really loves plants. And all the time I spent with him, probably 8 years, he was always like, you know, if you really want to know the plant, mark it and learn it in all seasons. And Mike Tennis is great. He can you know, he'll know a plant by last year's dead stubble. I mean,
that's exactly what you're looking for, to be able to recognize it in all of its faces, because as you pointed out, things really do change when they're budding, when they're in flower, when they're in fruit, and when they begin to senesce and die back to the ground for the herbaceous species. And that ability to recognize them in all of those different forms just gives you more skills and a greater ability to find what you're looking for. That's awesome, Steve.
No, yes, sir, you're right. It definitely gives you a great freedom and relief of, I don't know, it's hard to put into words when you really know your landscape.
I like that word you use, relief, because I think of it when a lot of people who may have had the unfortunate of not growing up with a lot of nature-based teachings, when they step out onto the landscapes, I mean, certainly they may recognize a few of the major trees and things, but largely they're like aliens on their own landscape. They're looking at all of these organisms, all of these plant lives that they can't recognize. And I could see it being potentially stressful if you were in a situation where you needed to rely on those plants for your well-being. And being able to recognize them all, it is a relief. It removes stress because you're among friends, for lack of a better word.
Exactly. So we have a ton to talk about. And at the end of the show, I definitely want to get your websites, your school locations, and all of that information, okay?
Excellent.
So at the end of the show, don't let me forget that.
You got it.
At this point, what I would like you to do is, if you want, tell us a little bit about what's going on currently in your world.
Well, my world right now is is pretty crazy, because in addition to the work that I do as a plant biologist and with the Delta Institute of Natural History, I'm also have been contracted to write a couple of books. One of those books is a large reference on rewilding, where what I would like to do is to sort of explain it in this way. We know that healthy eating is really important, and that we have ways of emulating hunter-gatherers and the way they ate, even using domesticated foods. And, you know, that's good, but humans need a lot more than just food. And then the paleo movement came along, and it did this really great job of linking movement and diet together. And I thought that was so wonderful, but there's still so much more that humans need. We're not focusing on what's in our water. We're not focusing on community, the kinds of medicines that we use, even an ability to push our limits through the use of hormesis. And so what I'm hoping to do is to create a reference that actually pulls together a much greater list of all of those things that I would argue, and I think many authors would argue, humans need for healthy living and reconnecting with nature in all of these different topics. So that's what this first big one is. And the second one will be a reference for using indigenous methods of child rearing in today and age. Many of the things that indigenous people were so good at, and the most important one is treating their children as sovereign humans instead of treating them as something that they could essentially inflict anything they wanted to upon them, is this a thought, if you will, of a way of looking at children that I'd really like to get out there to the world. And so it's going to be an entire book on how indigenous people raise their children and how we can incorporate those same methods for, you know, a much greater emotional health in our young people. So those are two big projects that are taking up so much of my time that I'm actually doing a lot less teaching, a lot less classes, individual numbers of classes than I would normally. And, you know, along with that, I'm trying to use social media to reach out with people. So I spend a fair amount of time donating what expertise I have on a Facebook site called Ancestral Plants. just recognizing that long connection that humans have had to plants. And this is a completely free open site that people can join and post questions about wild plants, really sort of anything that people have, from identification, food, medicine, fibers, even going on into spiritual topics if they prefer to. And so that's another place where I'm spending, you know, a little bit of time every day to help people reconnect with wild plants.
That's excellent, Arthur. I know through my years on the internet at different websites and social media places that you are all over the place, and your knowledge is definitely very deep, to put it lightly.
thank you.
No, I'm not even kidding. You're like a doctor. So how you use plants when you're reading the landscapes. This is kind of maybe falls more into an ecological tracking sort of.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great concept, see, because I don't think many people realize that if you are able to look at a landscape and identify the plants and sort of understand their ages, their physical forms, the species composition, it actually does help you to read the landscape in that sense of an ecological tracking. And I can try to give some specific examples. Of course, many people know that certain plants grow in very specific soils. Maybe there's a certain hydrology that they grow in. Certain plants require wet soils. Certain plants require very dry soils. And so knowing the existence of these plants on a landscape allows you to get an idea of the type of climate or even the amount of water that the soil holds on average throughout the year. But we have other things that maybe aren't quite as obvious to people if they're not looking for them, even like things like the wind flagging of trees, where the branches may be all directed in one direction because ice scour during the winter has essentially damaged the branches on the upwind side. And it gives us an idea about, you know, what these plants experience, particularly during the winter season. Maybe another good example is that difference between plants that grow when they're competing in a shaded environment. They grow very tall with no branches, low on their trunks, versus trees that will have these broad canopies with low down branches, indicating that they grew in a sunny situation because there was light reaching those lower branches to keep them alive. And it gives us a little understanding of the history of that site, that any tree that we see like that in a forest must have grown or, say, colonized an open field at some point because there was all of that sunlight reaching the lower part of the tree. I mean, these are just sort of what immediately comes to mind, just some of the examples of how we can use plants to actually tell us aspects of our landscape, including the weather it experiences, how much water the soil can hold, what the mean annual temperature is, even what minerals are available in that soil. I mean, we can see the difference based on how much calcium that we might get from the bedrocks, depending on what plants are growing on those soils. So your knowledge as a botanist definitely gives you these additional clues to read landscapes.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. My beau mentor in the South, there's a lot of Osage orange, Bodark, and he was showing me how the weather, when the weather will bend a tree around, there's actually better wood than others, than other parts on that tree that'll give you more, you know, better bow material.
Mm-hmm.
It really is all about reading the plant. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, in certain parts of the world, we can even get an idea of how long European colonists have been present by the numbers of non-native species that have been introduced from the old world and sometimes even from South America. There are literally places that we can go where nearly half of the vegetation that we might see on the landscape, which will include some edible and medicinal plants, some things that humans can use, but nearly half of those plants will actually be from other continents. And that gives us, again, this idea of how much activity humans have had in a particular area. Again, sort of an ecological tracking through time.
I out west, there was a specific grass that grew, you know, in massive fields, and it's extinct now because it was just plowed out. And the roots were actually like almost 4 foot long, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
obviously in some places, we've made some pretty massive alterations to the landscape. And the plants and the other wildlife all reflect that if we've been trained to see it.
Yeah. So I know you have like videos and website. I love all your stuff. I know you've studied primitive cultures extensively as well. Give us maybe an example or an idea of when gathering and hunting started to mix together, or I'm trying to conceptualize what I want to say here. When man decided that meat is helped with the greens, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. I understand what you're asking, Steve. Certainly, there's no doubt that our hominid ancestors, and I think it's good to point out that humans have been part of a separate lineage of primates that diverged from the other living primates about 7 million years ago. In other words, we've been on this track going through, you know, different now extinct hominids like, you know, the Australopithecus and Homo habilis and Homo erectus and Homo neanderthalensis and all of these people that are not necessarily our direct ancestors but share ancestors with us. And there's no doubt that even from before, you know, we were erect walking hominids, we were grabbing animals, small animals, anytime we could get our hands on them, and we would consume them as part of our diets. I mean, this kind of behavior is seen in chimpanzees and some other primates even today when the options arrive. I'll just call it this sort of, you know, stumbling upon food or something that can't run and is small, relatively defenseless, and we've been taking those kind of foods probably for an incredibly long time. But if we look to the archaeological record for when, you know, animal foods really began to become something much more substantial in our diets and maybe a more important part of, you know, how we built our form, I mean, that goes back approximately 3 million years ago. And I know there is some work that has shown that Homo habilis was breaking pieces of rock, specific kinds of rocks, to make sharp tools that they could use to cut flesh, the bones of larger animals. These animals may have been killed by other predators, and possibly these were the remains, or human groups may have tried to drive those predators away so they could have the carcass themselves. I'm not sure any of that is known, but there's even work going back before the genus Homo appeared on the planet, and to even some of the Australopithecus species have done the same thing. In other words, intentionally making stone tools to be able to cut animal flesh away from the bones. And we can actually see these grooves from where the stone tools cut into the bone as they were trying to carve away the flesh. So it's been a few million years that we have been sort of developing this diet that was rich in animal foods. And clearly it's a sort of a fundamental part of what it means to be human is this ability to eat this wide variety of foods, and perhaps even more importantly than that is our ability to use heat to cook those foods. We've been using fire for much longer than most people realize.
Wow. So obviously, beyond the easy grab for meat, skill sets began to be developed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting because the oldest bow artifacts, for example, that I'm aware of, there may be others that I haven't heard of, they're not particularly old. I mean, some of them 10, 12,000 years, about the maximum I've ever seen. You think about it, this just means that, you know, modern archery, and I say modern in the sense of the geological time scale, modern archery wouldn't really be that old. It's a relatively new thing. But fortunately, there was some work being done in Africa that found a whole series of stone points that they were able to study very carefully and determine that these were things that were hafted onto arrows. And so even though we don't have a bow to go back to, because of course wood doesn't necessarily last that long unless there are very specific conditions to prevent it from, you know, decaying and biodegrading, but stone lasts a lot longer. And that technology of making stone points to haft onto arrows to use for a bow has been dated back to about 65,000 years ago. So that is potentially before, you know, the movement off the African continent. In other words, before everyone began traveling to Asia and Europe and obviously ultimately North America, that bow technology may have originated prior to that date.
Wow, you're going to keep talking about Flint napping, and I know where I'm going to be this afternoon.
you and me both.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And so before the bow was obviously the atlatl, and that, you know, that was definitely a powerful weapon for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it radically changed the game because people could throw a dart, as it's called, which is essentially just a spear, at greater distances and at greater velocities than they could by their arm alone, because this spear thrower, typically made out of wood, was able to sort of increase the leverage. I mean, this ability for early humans to be able to take incredibly large animals, it would just, yeah, it was a complete game changer. The issue with the atlatl, of course, is that it works much better in open habitats because of the length of the dart and the movement that the arm needs to be able to make. And it's also a movement that animals can see coming and potentially dodge. And so it works better with really large things and not so good with smaller things. Like when we start getting down to the size of, you know, deer and smaller. And it's not that deer can be taken with an atlatl, because they are, but we're starting to deal with much faster animals. And that's where the bow really comes in, because the projectile is extremely fast and the movement needed to launch the projectile can be done slowly without alerting the animal to the presence of the hunter. So when we see the bow come on the scene, in many places, the atlatl begins to fade away. And of course, the atlatl is still used today in places, but replaced in most parts of the world with archery.
So, you know, with archery, you have to be able to set up an ambush unless you do a stalk hunt. And so this is kind of a development of animal tracking, I guess.
Absolutely, because, you know, bows and atlatls and things that kill by essentially cutting organs and veins and arteries and things of that nature so that they bleed, they're not always immediately lethal. And so animals can run for a time until they have lost too much blood. And I know that might sound very, you know, very harsh, but that is how bows kill. They kill by using, you know, typically a stone or today a metal blade to cut vessels that will leak blood. And so hunters did have to become expert trackers to be able to follow these animals, because we can't always just find blood on the ground. Sometimes the animal is bleeding primarily internally, and it's just the tracks. And see, for me, the abilities of the indigenous to be able to follow the individual track of the animal that they may have shot with an arrow that may be mixed in with other individuals of its species to know which animal they need to follow is just absolutely amazing. It's a tracking skill that's almost unbelievable by today's standards because people are so tracking illiterate.
It really is. In place, for example, in places of high deer population where a person would bow hunt, there are tracks everywhere. I mean,
yes.
Everywhere. And I think you've been there, and I've been there too. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I've had times where the tracking of animals has been incredibly difficult, and conditions have made it such that the tracking of deer that I've taken with projectile weapons has sometimes been extremely easy because they happened to be in an area that there weren't confounding things like an abundance of tracks that can really confuse those of us who love tracking, work on the skill of tracking, but we don't have the experience like an indigenous person who started it as a youth.
Born into it and lives it. Exactly.
Yeah, in a tracking culture, as opposed to people like you and I who are trying to rebuild tracking cultures.
Wow, there's a good concept.
Yeah, right?
So,
that's what we're trying to do.
Well, I know you do work a ton with plants, but do you teach tracking, or when you do teach tracking, what are some of the more important things you try to pass along?
Yeah, I do. I do spend most of my time in plants, but anytime I get the opportunity to offer a more broad skills primitive living class, where we're doing, you know, fire and shelters and maybe even some napping of stone and some of these sort of core skills that humans need to live outside of an urban environment, or I should say outside of a civilization. Tracking is a huge part of that. And I sort of look at it, I mean, I break it down, Steve, in the way that some other authors do, in that I look at there are these five things that are really important to know about tracks. And just to use the standard questions that we would use in the English language, that represents the who, the what, the when, the where, and the why. Those are the questions that I try to get people thinking about answering. And even though they may not have the skills to answer them initially, they're already thinking that tracking can allow us to not just identify the animal, that's the who, that's one of clearly the most important pieces, is to be able to understand who left that track, but also is, you know, answering that what gives us the ability to say, what was the animal doing at the time? Was it running? Was it fleeing from something? Was it heading to shelter? You know, these kinds of things that we can get from the what kinds of questions. The when, very obviously important, because if the tracks are extremely old, that's not likely an animal that we might be able to encounter or see, especially if it was simply passing through weeks ago. So the ability to age tracks is really important. The where is the part where we follow tracks, where we have learned how to go from track to track to track to be able to follow that animal for as far as we need to be able to, depending on what we're trying to accomplish. And then really, I love the why questions the most, because that's the largest set of questions. You know, why does the animal come here? Why does it pass only at dusk? Why does it bed in this area and not that area? You know, why is it moving in extreme haste? You know, we can just ask all of these kinds of questions, but the why, it really is that childlike curiosity being kindled in an adult. And so those are the things that I like to look at when I open people up to the concept of tracking, that we're not just looking at a single track and trying to decide who was it, but we've got all these other questions that we can answer about these other than human persons that we share the landscape with.
That's excellent, Arthur. Questioning awareness. I love that. That is excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me, it's probably still kind of snowy in Maine?
Yes, yep. And we've had the least amount of snow that I ever remember in my entire life, and the warmest, the most mildest winter that I can ever remember. But we do have snow still on the ground, and we just received another inch or so today, though it's being washed away by some rain. I was out today. I do try to go tracking every day. And, you know, sometimes it's only identifying the tracks, sometimes it's following them, and other times I'm trying to learn something very specific about an individual animal. And today it was, you know, it was good tracking. It was wonderful. There was ruffed grouse and porcupine.
Wow.
And a mink moving along a stream near our home. And we also had some dark-eyed juncos that were moving, you know, in some of the more open parts of our property where we live here in the mountains of Western Maine. And I feel like I'm forgetting another one that I want to mention. Most of the tracks that we see when we get into the north slopes here where the hemlocks are really abundant is, of course, red squirrels, really abundant. And, you know, we have lots of other animals that we see, but those are the ones that I saw today in my my tracking time outdoors.
Oh, yeah, wow. That is awesome. What kind of plants or trees would you be looking at, studying, trying to gather this time of year, I wonder?
Oh, good. That's a good question. And, of course, you know, here in the Maine winters, so much of the plants are actually locked below ground. I'm talking about those living parts of the plants, whether it's the perennial herbs that have underground storage organs of some kind, like a tuber or a corm that is sort of holding that plant, getting ready to emerge in the spring, or the annuals whose fruits are all, you know, in the seed bank waiting to spring up. You know, they're just locked away from us. So most of the plants that we're using this time of year are the woody species, the trees, the shrubs, the lianas, because those plants still have living tissue above ground this time of year. That inner bark is living tissue, as are their winter buds. And so while we do gather some wild foods this time of year, one of the real frequent ones that might be useful to mention is the bark of the eastern white pine. This is a species that was used by the indigenous. It has some really wonderful medicinal uses. It is phenomenally high in vitamin C, substantially higher than many of the citrus fruits that we think of as being high in vitamin C. It's extremely rich in a number of phenolic compounds that function as antioxidants in our body, that protect our blood vessels from damage, and even help us to not only defend ourselves from, say, a pre-diabetic or a diabetic condition, but even heal the damage that diabetes has done to our body. And of course, we're not using it in those ways. We're primarily using it for its plant chemistry to keep us strong and for what vitamins and minerals it can provide, typically using the inner bark to make teas to go with our meals this time of year. And there's a lot of others, but that's one of the real prominent ones that figures high in our diet this time of year.
Well, that sounds great. I mean, not primarily use pine needle tea, but it sounds close and literally.
Oh, they're very, very similar, Steve. Yeah, very similar. You barely know the difference. The only reason I'm using the bark is because it has a little bit of a richer phytochemistry content, and it turns out that the vitamin C content, at least in tests that have been done, is actually about 6 or 7 times higher than the leaves, the needles. But that doesn't mean that those parts aren't wonderful as well. Typically, what I'll do is I'll remove a small branch from the tree and come home and scrape the bark off and use that to make it. In other words, I'm not girdling the larger trunk of the trees to be able to do this. And so, you know, if I don't have access to the bark, I'm going to use the leaves as well because I like those very much.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So this is a short radio show, and we haven't not scratched the surface. I wonder what would you tell a person over a radio channel if they wanted to learn the plants? Nobody has 1,000 hours a week, unfortunately. What would be the best way to focus in and really start learning?
You know, a lot of people, if they want to learn about plants, especially when it comes to trying to learn edible and medicinal plants, they will often go to classes designed for that. And that's a great way to learn. But if you are really pushed for time, or you happen to be in a location where you can't find a foraging instructor, don't fret. Because the biggest obstacle that modern people face to learning about plants is actually learning how to identify plants. Because there's a specific vocabulary for describing the kinds and the arrangements of plant structures. And there are all of these shape terms and texture terms and even different kinds of hairs that occur on a plant that we use to identify the species. And those are not things that you necessarily can only learn from a foraging instructor. Those are things that you can actually learn by going on wildflower walks, being involved in Audubon, or even finding, you know, field botany classes that you can take. And so the reality is the obstacle of identification, the biggest one that's standing in your way, doesn't require a foraging instructor for you to pass by. In other words, for you to overcome that obstacle, there are other people and other books. Various wildflower books will help you learn about the terminology so that you're able to start learning how to identify plants on your own. And that's really where I'm going with this answer, Steve, is don't only learn just the plants that you were shown. Learn the vocabulary so that you can teach yourself and you can learn how to identify new species of plants that you encounter. The easiest thing of all is to look up how a plant might get used. And yes, of course, we can run into some inconsistencies between what authors are saying of how to use a particular plant. But for the most part, looking up how a plant can be used is pretty easy to do. But if you don't know what the plant is in front of you, your ability to learn more about it gets stymied very quickly. So focus on the identification aspect first. It will allow you to then learn the other aspects in time, at home, reading, and with other instructors that you happen to encounter. Botany is a big topic, and so don't think you're going to learn it all at once. I mean, I've been a botanist for 25 years, and I'm still learning about plants. Think of each plant as a new skill that you've learned. Don't think of botany as one skill, but think of each piece of information, each plant that you encounter as this new skill, so that you have a way of not being so daunted by this massive volume of information, because botany is a lifelong pursuit.
Arthur, I like that last part about each plant is its own skill. I never thought of it that way, and I will remember that. That is excellent.
Yeah, it's definitely helpful because sometimes we tend to shy away from some of the really big topics. And, you know, we don't have to do that. We can take, okay, sugar maple. This is my new skill I'm going to work on with plants this week. Or, you know, the blackberry. I'm not just going to learn about its fruit, but I'm going to learn how it's used for medicine. And when you break the botany down in that way, whether it's edible botany or medical botany or utilitarian botany, it makes it so that we can take this one stride at a time and not just become completely overwhelmed.
That is awesome. That is awesome. So we invited you to this show, and before I continue, I want to make sure that I don't bypass anything that you may have wanted to share with us that I haven't covered.
Well, how about, if you don't mind, I read you a paragraph. And this is a paragraph that actually is coming from the rewilding book that I mentioned earlier in the show, because tracking is something that I briefly cover in it. And so this will be a short preview. And the section is called The Ground is a Manuscript. And this is it. This is just a little preview of the content. Awareness provides the opportunity to learn that we are not alone in this world, that we share our landscapes with an array of other than human persons. Some of these organisms are mobile and some are sedentary. Some communicate by sounds and behaviors and others by pollen and complex chemistry. But regardless of their life histories, all of the world's life leaves behind a record of its existence, though this record may be fleeting in some species. Tracking is one of those skill sets that humans use to read the evidence left behind of an organism's passage. It is a talent that was learned by ancient hominids and passed down through our ancestral lineage to those alive today. It is more than merely an ability to identify the organism who left the track. It is also the ability to create a story from the collection of marks and other signs left upon the ground, or in the snow, on vegetation, etc. As Mark Elbrock describes it, it is the union of science and storytelling. It is a uniquely human trait. While wolves, for example, can bring the scent of an animal back to the pack by rolling on its carcass or in its feces, this behavior cannot describe the scene, detail the events, and interpret the meaning of actions carried out by wildlife or domesticated life in question. Truly, when humans relearn the art of tracking, in other words, when they recover tracking literacy, the ground is a manuscript with detailed stories that will come alive for anyone with skill and creativity.
Wow. Wow. What is the name of that book?
Well, it's currently titled A New Path, and I have no idea if the publisher will keep that title or not. But I'll certainly announce it through my channel as I get closer. I'm on the home stretch of finishing up a draft. I hope to be done this coming summer, and then there will be the editorial process and then the printing of the book.
Excellent. Every one of us are always waiting for new books.
books are our mentors in this day and age. You know, and it seems they're such a pale shadow of what an actual nature literate mentor is. But the reality is, you know, many of us have big natural history libraries because it's how we're learning. But fortunately, we'll recover that and we'll one day become mentors and elders for people so that they can learn firsthand the way humans are supposed to learn.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Oh, that's awesome stuff. I know that you have one website, I believe, is arthurhaynes.com.
That's right. Yep, that's my primary website where I try to advertise sort of my classes and what's going on, and occasionally publish blogs to get people thinking about, you know, how much nature divorcement in humans is actually harming our health. And then I do, you know, out of necessity, I wish this were not true, I tried to hold off for the longest time, Steve, but I finally realized that so much of the world is on Facebook that if I don't have some presence there, I lose the ability to communicate with so much of the world. And so I have an Arthur Haynes page, a teacher page, as well as the group called Ancestral Plants that I mentioned earlier in the show.
Ancestral Plants and Arthur Haynes, both on Facebook. Unfortunately, you are correct. It is a great place, an easy place, and that's where everybody seems to be.
Yeah.
So I just off the top, off topic. I know you shoot primitive bows. I know you make them. What is your favorite wood to work?
Oh, that's a good question. Now, I need to give two answers here, Steve, because my favorite wood to work in terms of ease and my favorite wood to work in terms of the look and the feel and the function of the finished bow. Okay, if that's okay, I'm going to give two answers.
Yes, I love it.
All right. So, of course, all kinds of woods make highly functional bows. And in this part of the world, we have a wonderful tree called white ash that I'm sure many people are familiar with. It can grow straight without, you know, much crooks and turns and kinks. It splits very easy. It's abundant for us. And it is one of the woods that I love having novice bowyers learn on because it doesn't have interlocking grains, so the wood doesn't tear and leave gouges in the wood like some species. Like I have a much harder time working elm if I'm not dealing with an ultra-sharp tool to work on that. So white ash is one of the most beautiful and easy to sculpt trees for making bows out of. Though I have to say, my real passion is not with white wood bows like white ash, which would be called a white wood where the sapwood is left on the bow, but really working with the heartwood species where the outer sapwood is removed and that dark interior heartwood is what we use to make the bow. And you know, I love Osage Orange. I love mulberry. But probably my favorite, because it does grow here in the Northeast, is black locust. It's a beautiful yellow heartwood. It takes bending really well, and it just builds wonderful bows that are really effective.
Nice. Nice. Yeah, I have to get into some black locust. Let's see. What else, Arthur? Obviously, there's no way we can cover anything in a short time.
Understood.
I really wish I could get over to Maine to hang out with you, take some classes.
Where are you from, Steve?
I am currently in Western Washington, but I was in Arkansas.
Yeah, you're literally on the other side of the continent.
But a lot of things are the same here. They got hemlocks and
we do have some similarities, you know, based on, especially if you're in an area that has, you know, a decent rainfall, so you're not dealing with a really dry climate compared to Maine, because we're anything but dry here. You know, humidity is a real problem for us. Water, it's everywhere. It's never an issue for us to locate water. What is an issue for us is kindling fire and keeping it going using primitive methods. Our real trick in this kind of environment because of the rain and the humidity that we deal with.
Wow. Yeah. Arthur, any parting thoughts?
That's a good question. Well, I guess, you know, we've talked about plants and tracking here, but I would really leave that as a parting thought that tracking is, let me say, Steve, if everyone had the ability to not just find tracks, but interpret to some extent the meaning of the tracks on the ground, I'm really convinced that some of the things due to this world, the harmful things, both intentionally and unintentionally, would be a lot harder for people to do, because let's face it, many of the mammals that we see, or at least see the signs of on our landscapes, are relatively secretive. They're species that get hunted because of their meat or their hides or because they're considered nuisances. And these animals have learned to try to keep a very low profile. And what that means is that people living in a lot of settings simply don't see all of the wildlife that's actually out there. But the tracks give us this ability to see that we are truly not alone on this planet. We can see that there's all manners of animals in this intricate ecology who need to have the forests standing, the prairies untilled, need the wetlands undrained, in other words, intact with all of the water held in place. And tracking gives us that ability to see we're not alone. And I really feel that some of what happens on this planet is a result of people simply not being able to see what it is we do to the rest of the world. Tracking is a way to recover that lost sight.
Yes, you hit the nail on the head, and I'm not entirely sure any of our other interviews have even touched on what you're touching on here, and that's basically that re-education will help this planet.
Yes, yes. I'm a firm believer that education, well, the kind of education that we tend to get, which really sets up well for living in civilization, doesn't give us the faculties to see what's going on in the rest of the world, which would be the natural settings. And so without that education, people can't see. And if they can't see, I'm not saying they're not to blame, that they don't have any, you know, any part of the blame in what's going on, but it's easier to understand why we have apathy, because we just don't understand how many things are out there that we're affecting.
You mentioned tracking is helping, and I got to tell you just a real quick little story. I was tracking deer, and this was in Arkansas. I was tracking some deer, and you know, I knew the tree mimosa. I knew what it was, and it was early spring, and it was so fresh. You know, the mimosa has like that real dainty, soft, fern-like foliage. It just dries up really fast in the south. But it was still fresh, and they had only been there like maybe 20 minutes before I got there. And it was 2 years later before I found out that we can eat the fresh growth on mimosa. Just peel the outside skin, and the inside is like sweet celery.
Nice.
So yeah. So tracking definitely helps in a lot of ways. I wonder if you've ever found anything like that where an animal led you to a food that you didn't know you could eat.
Well, I've definitely followed tracks for a long period of time that took me into parts of the landscape that I hadn't explored before, only you know, hidden waterfalls, two massive, still incredibly beautiful spots, or cliffs, or just really neat sections of forest that I had never bothered to go to before without this this intention of following the animal's track and saying, I'm just going to go and let it take me where it goes, only to find these awesome areas that turn out to be, you know, places that I return to from my childhood. To this day, I'm still going back to some of these places.
I see what you're saying. If you don't get off the trail and follow those tracks, you'll never see. Well, you might,
there's so much hidden out there that the tracking can take us to. There's no doubt about it. And I love your example, Steve. That's wonderful.
Oh, well, the sad part was how shocked I was when I found out I could eat it. So then I started teaching it in my classes. You know, my classes are obviously subpar to yours, but, you know, I teach basic wildlife.
It's all important. And we're all able to hit different educational levels. You know, the fact is the world doesn't need necessarily all expert botanists. It just needs people who have the enthusiasm and can get people started on this path. So, yeah, don't discredit what you're doing, Steve. I'm sure it's incredibly valuable.
Well, thank you, Arthur. Thank you. I really appreciate you taking out the time. I know your life is very busy, and I really appreciate you taking out the time to talk with us. So.
Oh, this was great. Talking to fellow trackers is different than often talking with other people. Trackers have a unique insight into the sort of workings and the going-ons in the natural world, and so it's always fun talking with other trackers.
Yes, sir, yes, sir. You know, the question that will always hinge in my brain is, what am I missing?
Yeah, you have the curiosity that we need to rekindle in people, because most people either don't even ask the question, or don't care what they're missing. And if we can get that art of questioning going strong again, it will be to everyone's benefit.
Arthur Haynes, I appreciate you, sir. You guys, everybody should check out ArthurHaynes.com and on Facebook, Arthur Haynes, and also Ancestral Plants. And he has some great videos out there. I urge everybody to check out his work. It will bring you deeper into the natural world.
Thanks very much, Steve. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you, Arthur. I really appreciate it, sir. It's been a privilege. And you have a good day, sir.